Okay, welcome everybody. Today, June 26, 2024, another Wednesday webinar. Today, we're definitely going to be doing questions and answers since I keep promising to do those. And people are kindly sending in a number of questions, so it seems only fair to get to them. I'm not sure that there's any announcements. I just posted a interview with Kelly Brogan, which everybody should check out, and she's doing I think a free master class tomorrow night, Thursday night. So you may have a chance to sign up for that. And the only other thing I wanted to say before I got to the questions is there's the good news is we're getting a lot more activity. I've been saying this for a while on the no virus virus debate, and a lot more people are weighing in on it. I mostly hear about these things. I must admit, I don't tend to read the whole articles or watch the videos. It's just hard for me to sit through most of them. But anyways, I'm sure you'll see them. The Michael Palmer wrote another rebuttal, and apparently he doesn't believe in the one of the fundamental laws of life, which is if you find yourself in a hole, the first thing to do is stop digging. I think everybody should remember that. I try to remember that. But apparently he doesn't believe in that, so he keeps digging a further hole. And I think Doctors Tenpenny and Pilevsky weighed in. And I think one of the ways of describing a lot of what you'll read and hear is actually an interesting word, which I had to look up to get the exact meaning of, but I've heard it a lot. It's a variation on the W.C. Fields quote that if you can't dazzle them with brilliance, baffle them with bullshit. And the word is sophistry. So I did look up what that word means because I wasn't sure. And it said subtle, tricky, superficially plausible, but generally fallacious method of reasoning. And that's pretty much describes exactly what you'll hear from most of the people who are trying to fight back. What's so interesting about it is they don't seem to realize that this is a tremendous gift to the perpetrators of this fraud and the whole plandemic sort of thing. Because as soon as we get rid of the virus argument, including the lab created and lab engineered nonsense and all that, we end up in two places. One is a whole lot less fear of what your neighbor or friend or crowds are going to do for you because you realize there's no virus to pass between people. So you start living life a lot less fearful, which then improves your health and everybody gets better from that. The second thing is at some point, people will start to investigate what actually does make people sick. And there is a possibility then that that actually leads to a much saner and healthier and better world because people will stop doing the things which are actually making them sick and actually making people around the world sick, which has nothing to do with these imaginary viruses. I just wanted to give an example of one of these sophistry type arguments. I don't have the quote here to show you, but you can probably take my word for it or go look it up. It had to do with the idea that you can't prove anything in science. And so the criticism of us being the no virus people, is we have this extraordinary high, like burden of proof that we're putting on the virus people. And so, because of that, and because you can't actually prove anything in science, they say that we will never be satisfied, and you can never prove this one way or another. So it becomes just an irrational, ridiculous argument. That, of course, it has nothing to do with what we're saying. We all realize, and I certainly realize, that you cannot prove something doesn't exist, because if somebody ends up finding it or proving it does at some point, you would have been proven wrong. But what you can do, and what it is that we're doing, is we can investigate the claim, for instance, that the virologists say that when you get a cytopathic effect, CPE, in a cell culture, that proves there was a virus in the sample. That's what they say. In fact, that is how they proved for decades that there was a virus. They put an unpurified sample, or actually partially purified, they never put an actual virus on a cell culture, and then did it without the virus and see if you got a cytopathic effect. Now, we have proven, and there's many, many examples in the literature, that you get a cytopathic effect even without a sample and even without putting something on which could contain a virus. So we have disproven that that procedure proves there is a virus. And then the reality is, if that's what you're going to claim is the proof of the existence, and that is clearly, and I would think even at this point, everybody agrees. Now, even the virologists say, right, well, sometimes you have viruses that they don't cause CPE. So it turns out, on the one hand, they say you get a cytopathic effect that proves there's a virus. And then they turn around and say, or if you don't get a cytopathic effect, that proves there was a virus that was harmless and it was just living happily in the cells. And that's basically sophistry nonsense. So that has been disproven. Now, that means you have to come up with some other way to try to prove that that thing exists. And they did, actually. So with HIV, they said, well, viruses, HIV, has different proteins than the lymphocyte that it infects. Let me just be clear about that. You got this lymphocyte, it's kind of white blood cell. It's in your body. And they say this person's T lymphocytes are infected with HIV, and the HIV has different proteins than the T lymphocyte. Obviously, because it's a different organism, right? So it's got to have proteins which are unique to HIV. So that's the claim. So then you do a study. This was the Gelderblum study. You do an electrophoresis. In other words, you examine all of the proteins in a infected T lymphocyte. You get, I think the number was 28 proteins. Right? So those are the proteins that were from allegedly the T lymphocyte and the HIV. Okay? So then you do a T lymphocyte that couldn't possibly be infected with HIV, and you do the same procedure, and lo and behold, you get the same 28 proteins. Now, that's a very easy thing to sort out if you're willing to think. Which means that all of those 28 proteins came from the T lymphocyte. There was no HIV proteins. There are no proteins that are unique. Whether they're in different ratios, that has no relevance, because obviously one is in a sick person and one is in a well person. So one could imagine they have different proteins. But there are no HIV proteins. And if there are no HIV proteins, then it's not a distinct organism. In other words, it's not different from the T lymphocyte, which means it's not there, which means you've disproven that as a method of claiming the virus exists. And so that's what we mean by proving things. And they turn that around using sophistry to try to confuse you so that you don't think in a normal way. And as I keep saying, that's because most doctors and scientists seem to have a thought disorder, which I think we should have a new syndrome called medical school acquired thought disorder. Could be also, there's a variation of it, or a variant of this, which is called PhD program acquired thought disorder. And it is, that is contagious, and it is rampant in our system. And so a lot of people have come down with that disease, and it's pretty easy to spot if you're just willing to take a few minutes to actually think. Okay, hopefully that's clear, so you'll know you can get a good laugh when you read and watch these different people trying to demonstrate their knowledge of virology. One thing I forgot to say last time, because I forgot to emphasize, there is a third reason why people get this wrong. So the first two I outlined, one is that they have one of these thought disorders that I just outlined, the medical school or PhD program acquired thought disorder. So that's the common one, and most people in a, have a similar kind of thought disorder where they're not able to actually think through the process. So that's the most common reason why people get this wrong. And then there is a very few, a very minor subset of people who are have nefarious interests. So they're basically lying, and they have different financial interests or power interests or something. And I don't think that happens very much, but it is possible, and it probably does happen some. There is a third reason, which I forgot to emphasize, which I would say is a legitimate reason, which is that you just don't care. And this is common. For instance, I've said this many times. Like, I know nothing about car engines and carburetors. In fact, truth be told, I don't even know whether modern cars have carburetors or whether somehow that's an old-fashioned engine technology which has gone by the wayside and modern cars don't even have carburetors. Frankly, I don't know. And mostly, if somebody tried to explain it to me, I would probably kind of go blank. Because frankly, I don't really give a damn about carburetors, and I don't really give a damn about cars. I've only in my life chosen cars because I could afford them, they were reliable and got me where I wanted to go in reasonable comfort. And besides, further than that, I didn't have any particular interest in cars. Fair enough. We all have subjects like that. The point, though, that I want to make is you are never going to hear me make public criticism or arguments about for or against the existence or the function of carburetors. I'm not going to do that because I know I don't know anything about it, and that's fair enough as long as you just don't weigh in on it. So I don't know why these people who don't actually take the effort and time to look into it. They could just say they just don't care whether it's viruses or not. What difference does it make? I mean, I don't agree. If you're a medical doctor, it seems like you ought to know that, but you know, fair enough. If you don't want to know, you don't want to know. Just don't weigh in on it and pretend you're writing these scholarly papers about or videos about critical thinking and arguments for the viruses because you just don't know. Okay, it's enough of that. Can you go over the lymphatic system, how it works to help it what it does or do what it does, I guess? So I've never really looked into the lymphatic system or heard anything about it, particularly from any kind of new biology standpoint. So I'm mostly relying on what I learned and what I was told, which, as I've said, almost always turns out to be incorrect. But let me just give a stab at it. So we have two, yeah, well, we have more than two. We have cerebrospinal circulation. That's the fluid in our cerebrospine. We have blood, which everybody knows about. And then we have lymph and lymphatic circulation, which, unlike the blood, which is red, the lymph is more like a creamy sort of whitish color. And it carries different substances, mostly certain proteins, I think, around the body. And it also helps pick up debris and waste products from the tissues, and it circulates them and helps them to be eliminated. And one should, of course, have a robustly flowing lymph system. And if you don't, you get lymphatic congestion. And then wherever that congestion is, you'll get swelling and edema in that arm, or sorry, in that part of your body. And this happens, for instance, when you take out the lymph nodes of a woman with breast cancer and you take the lymph nodes out of her armpit. So the lymph nodes are essentially like railroad stations that are in. So the lymph channels would be the railroad tracks and the lymph nodes would be the railroad stations. So the lymph is flowing like the train is moving along the track. And then it comes to these stations, and then this in the station, the waste product is dealt with. And then if there's supposedly cancer in that's traveling in these lymph channels, then you have to take all the lymph tissue out and the lymph nodes out. And then then that interferes with the flow. And so you get a backup of the lymph in the arm or in the leg or wherever you removed or you have, disturbed or injured or congested or too full lymph nodes, then the flow can't go through properly and you get backed up. And then you get pain and all kinds of symptoms because you have a congestion in your lymph. Now, the lymph, like the blood, moves because of the dynamics of water. So there's the lymph, like any fluid, is partly made of water with proteins, and that, of course, forms this sort of structured water, which has a charge, which then moves the fluid. So that's one way, but my guess is that mechanism of moving the lymph is minor, and that it moves mostly because of the motion or the movement of the muscles in the body, particularly in the spiral motion of the muscles. And this is something that Pat at our New Biology Clinic often talks about, and that when you're moving your muscles properly and walking in a proper gait with proper posture and sitting and doing all the various movements, then you're creating all these different spiral motions, which then have the effect of massaging these lymph channels and even massaging probably the lymph nodes and helping the movement and the flow of the lymph in these channels. And so this has given rise to one of the primary ways of helping move the lymph in a healthier way, which is called lymphatic massage, which is basically like a kind of rhythmical movement of the tissues, hopefully in a sort of spiral rhythmical way, which then increases the flow in the lymph, flow in the lymph channels. There are also different herbs that are reported to help with lymphatic movement. I don't remember exactly which ones they were, but I think like pokeweed was one. I think echinacea is reportedly able to do that. And probably any time that you lessen your toxic load, because that ultimately is the thing which is congesting your lymph system is there's a combination of lack of proper spiral-based movement and toxic buildup in the lymph channels. So anything you can do about that will increase the lymph flow, and healthy lymph flow is one of the requirements or the conditions of a healthy life. Okay, number two, I would love to know what you think the cause of molluscum contagiosum is. Kids never had that when I was a kid, and now it seems like every kid is breaking out in these warts all over their body. I was wondering if you think it's from the repression of symptoms from MMR vaccines. Right. I remember in my first probably 15 years in as a medical doctor, a lot of them, my patients were children. I don't think I ever saw anybody with molluscum contagiosum. It's an interesting name. It sounds like you've been bitten by a snail or something, but it has nothing to do with snails. In fact, according to conventional pediatrics and medicine and dermatology, the cause is currently unknown, or at least it was 10 years ago, last time I looked. So for some reason, they haven't been able to put in this one on a virus or even a bacteria or a fungus or anything. It just comes for unknown reasons. And you get these raised lumps, and they come in clusters, and they often have a little bit of a sort of cheesy discharge on the interior. And then it's true, over the last 10 years, I wouldn't say every child that I had as a patient had molluscum, but a lot of them did. So it seems to have been increasing for whatever reason. And I don't know that well, I know that I don't know exactly the cause, but I think one way you can think of this is we have many different. So whenever you're having things erupt through the skin, that means that the normal eliminations and toxic remediation channels have been, overloaded, so to speak, or are full. And so the body uses accessory detoxification mechanisms in order to cleanse itself. So obviously the rash is a positive development, right? You are getting rid of things that your body in its wisdom doesn't want inside you. And then the only other step is the type of rash or the appearance of the rash or the constituents of the discharge is a reflection of what it is that you're trying to get rid of. So, unfortunately, medicine has taken to claiming that these are different diseases. So, this is molluscum, and this is measles, and this is chickenpox, and this is smallpox, and this is monkeypox. And those are because there's different viruses, they claim. We know that's not true. But what is true is there are certain obviously categories of things that one is it needs to get rid of, at particularly for children. Some of them have to do with excessive growth and, say, collagen deficiencies. Others have to do with certain types of environmental toxins that children are typically exposed to, or nutritional issues that children are exposed to, or things that are being injected or children are being exposed to at various years. And then if there's a particular kind of material that needs to be eliminated, it will obviously look the same in many different children. So interestingly, after this first question, you see this sort of cheesy discharge in the center of these molluscum lesions. So there's obviously some proteinaceous matter. That's what this sort of cheesy discharge. It actually looks sort of like congealed lymph, which is a highly proteinaceous material, probably with some other things that you don't want in there. And so it probably is that many children are exposed to this kind of insult. I don't know what the insult is. And that's why it's a common experience to get this type of looking rash. With all of these problems, the solution is obvious, which is don't put any of those stuff in that your body will need to be eliminated, and then use various detoxification procedures to help eliminate it. I can tell you that with adults and with what we're seeing at the clinic and what I'm having reported to me from many different friends and people who write in and stuff, if all you know about medicine is a combination of turpentine protocol, according to what Andy has taught us, and coffee enemas and castor oil packs, you can heal pretty much most things just using that. So if you have a child who's sick, you can give them even a little bit of an enema, even with a bulb syringe. Don't know that you need to use coffee in a child. I'm talking more about adults, and that will help open the bile ducts, will help the bile flow, which is the way that your liver gets rid of the poisons. And if you it's a fat soluble type of toxin, the turpentine will help with that. And if it's any kind of congestion in the liver or lymph, the castor oil packs will help with that. If all you know about therapies is those three simple things, you'll be able to heal a lot of things. Okay, my dentist tells me I need a root canal. I see the x-ray and the infection is obvious. He says it's bad for my health to keep this infection in my mouth. I've tried to get rid of it in the past 2 years, but the x-rays come back with no change. My one health problem is I forget words. My tooth hurt a few years ago, but now it doesn't. Should I get the root canal? So obviously, I can't really answer yes or no. It depends which tooth it is. Basically, an infection means there's dead and dying tissue. And so the bacteria are coming to help clean up the debris. And if it's been going on for years, then it's likely that tooth is probably dying. And depending on where the tooth is, I would really look into removing the tooth and having it properly cleaned up, rather than actually having a root canal. We are actually looking into trying to find a dentist to help with the clinic to try to really give a more professional answer to these questions, because I don't know that much or really anything really about dentistry. I know that there are people who do things like giving ozone injections in the area. So basically, your only other recourse is to do things that would try to revitalize the tissue. You know, what I've heard, which I have never really seen much in practice, is that people who eat more or less a very low or carbohydrate-free diet for a while, more like a sort of carnivore diet, and take a high-fat diet, especially cod liver oil, and not a lot of it, but a little bit, and emu oil or butter oil, and eat, you know, organ meats, et cetera, and then have maybe ozone treatments in the air, they can revitalize the tissue, and then the infection, so-called, the bacteria will stop growing there, because as soon as the tissue is more viable, then the bacteria don't need to be there, and the so-called infection will go away. It's obviously no way that I can tell you in your case. It sounds like it's been going on for a long time. And so all I can say is in that case where the tissue can't be revitalized and therefore the bacteria go away, I would really consider having the tooth removed rather than doing a root canal. Okay, another question which I probably can't give a really good answer to, but a friend just got diagnosed with stage four melanoma. What can help him? Again, not to always be advertising for the clinic, but we actually just had a case of somebody with a stage four melanoma who now has a clean scans based on this programs that they did, I think, under the guidance of the clinic. So this can be done, just like it can be done with pretty much any cancer. Now, it's not always successful. There's so many factors that play into whether somebody will be successful with any illness, but particularly an illness like cancer. You have to understand the origin of it, and you have to understand that even these symptoms that we call stage four melanoma are still your body's attempt to heal. And once you understand that, the question becomes different, which is heal from what? And then you start looking into your belief systems, your toxic load, the way you live, the way you think, the way you sleep, the clothes you wear, the food you eat, the shoes you put on your feet or not. You start looking at all the different things that you're doing in your life, and you start rehabilitating the way you live to be a way that is more friendly to the way your body wants, so it doesn't have to put this garbage in ever more garbage bags. That is the problem with cancer. Again, it can work. I would highly suggest getting some professional sort of guidance with this. There are various programs and various ways of doing this that have been more successful than others. In other words, not just doing it on yourself. This is the first time you've ever tried to treat any significant illness, and so you're just essentially flying blind. So I would suggest getting some guidance and some help. And I just would strongly encourage that anybody who really wants to embark on this type of program has to be willing to look at all the factors that go into what does it mean to have a healthy life. And that particularly means the emotional, psychological, life factors. You know, who are you and how did you get here? That has to be on the table. And there's a lot we can learn from, you know, things like German New Medicine as to how to organize our thinking around this. We also have to engage in some sort of understanding of the body is trying to do the best that it can. We have to therefore work with the body and understand that if it's making tumors, making nasty stuff, and putting it in garbage cans, that we have to lessen the burden so that isn't the only solution the body has. So that's how I would say that. Okay, my mother-in-law has arrhythmia atrial fibrillation, and I am looking into ashwagandha and strophanthus for her. Do you consider strophanthus a good supportive option for this problem? So the first thing I would say about that is strophanthus is definitely not an so-called anti-arrhythmic drug or medicine. And what I mean by that is, so in cardiology, would I say this? It's not an absolute split, but basically there are rhythm problems and there are more sort of functional muscle problems. Let's say it like that. Sometimes the two get confused. There are situations where it seems to be a pure, like, electrical rhythm problem. That was like the SVT that I had and wrote about in the heart book. That seems to be more or less a pure electrical problem. How do we know that? Because it usually starts very early, like in my case, you know, in my early childhood. So there was no real evidence of a metabolic problem at that point. It's unlikely that that's the case. But there could be, so there's something going on with the electrical activity of the heart. And those we call arrhythmias. And even though I've spent a number of times trying to treat people with arrhythmias with strophanthus, including myself, I would say it was uniformly unsuccessful. So I would make this the case now that strophanthus is not a good anti-arrhythmic medicine. In fact, mostly I have found very few things are, I would say, strongly effective for purely rhythmical problems. I think now, unlike what I thought when I was practicing, there's now a problem. There's some toxic exposure that's interfering with the way the nerves are able to structure their water and carry the impulses that we call the electrical activity. And so that's how I would look at treating that problem now. On the other hand, we have many problems, including, congestive heart failure and so-called coronary artery disease or heart attacks, chest pain, angina, and atrial fibrillation, which I would call metabolic problems of the heart. So then the question, what do I mean by a metabolic problem? That means the heart muscle, the tissues of the heart, are not extracting fuel and getting rid of waste products as they should. One could even place that as a potentially a problem with the mitochondria in the heart tissue. And we know that just by examination, the heart has the highest concentration of mitochondria of any tissue in the body. And so these are the energy generating power plants of our tissues. And the heart has a lot of them because the heart needs a lot of energy, apparently, to create this electrical field, which then organizes the rest of the body to be a coherent whole. It is the origin of this toroidal field around the body, and that takes apparently a lot of energy to create that electrical field, and that seems to be generated in the mitochondria. By the way, that's not the same as saying the mitochondria make ATP and the ATP is the energy. The mitochondria generate something which helps in this creation of this electrical field that is generated by the heart. When that energy generation is interfered with, usually because of some insult to the mitochondria, which can be a variety of things, including seemingly metal toxicity. It could be antibiotics because the mitochondria have a certain similarity with bacteria. So antibiotics are directly toxic to mitochondrial function. I wouldn't be surprised if emotional, psychological influences and problems with the purity or the organization of the water, mineral deficiencies, etc., all are part of the origin of having a metabolic deficiency of the heart. In other words, a mitochondrial defect in the mitochondria in the heart tissues. When that happens, you get dysfunction of the heart tissue, which means it doesn't create the spiral that it needs to, which is different than beating, but it doesn't twist like it's supposed to, which helps with the regulation of the circulation and the ejection of the blood. And when that becomes severe enough, you end up with congestive heart failure, and the heart becomes more bulbous, more circular, as it actually tries to squeeze the blood out, which is a very inefficient way to move the blood in the ventricles. So it gets bigger and circular. You can see that on an X-ray. And that's as it's failing. As it fails, it's trying to do something to keep the blood moving forward. So it starts to get bigger so that it can actually contract. And that's a sort of failing spiral. And that's why it needs more and more energy, and the people with congestive heart failure end up getting emaciated because more and more energy goes to fueling this activity of the heart in the wrong way, a beating instead of a vortexing, or a pumping instead of a vortexing. And that's the same thing. That's the same dynamics that happens with atrial fibrillation. And once that happens, it sends off distress signals from various parts of the tissue, which then create abnormal, irregular electrical activity, which is what we see as atrial fibrillation. Now, the strophanthus will help with the metabolic efficiency of the heart. That's what strophanthus does. That has been looked at for 100 years. I've been over that many times. So in that sense, it will help with the underlying issue that has led to atrial fibrillation, but it won't convert the person from atrial fibrillation into a normal sinus rhythm. I've literally never seen that happen. So over time, it will help to restore the metabolic integrity of the tissues of the heart, and the atrial fibrillation might get better, but that will be a long road and probably not going to happen quick enough for your liking. So there's other things you can do. Magnesium sometimes helps in various forms. I've always liked to use the subdermal or sub the ointment of the magnesium, which you can actually rub over your chest, and that will the magnesium will be absorbed into the tissues, and that has helped a number of people with different rhythm problems, because it seems like magnesium has something to do with the magnesium deficiency with the generation of arrhythmias. Ashwagandha is a very good herb. It's an Ayurvedic herb primarily, which is for adrenal stress, and I'm sure there's some stressful component to any rhythm problem, but I've never seen that ashwagandha by itself or with strophanthus will convert a abnormal rhythm into a normal rhythm. If it does happen, I'd love to hear about it, but my guess is it wouldn't happen like that. Okay, my 38-year-old son thinks his high cholesterol will cause, quote, heart disease. He is on a crazy diet and losing weight, was normal, now too thin. How can I explain the truth to him? Please explain it to all of us. You know, I watched a very good interview that was done. Everybody should watch the Sam Bailey's weekly show. It's actually the only one that I typically watch every week. And she was interviewing this French statistician guy who has written a number of books, or at least a book on COVID and going through all the statistics, which convinced him that there was no pandemic and eventually that there couldn't have possibly been any contagious infectious process. And you can watch the reasons why he said that. And the reason I bring him up now, besides encouraging everybody to watch that show, is he said something very interesting when he was investigating the virus issue or investigating whether vaccines are really safe and effective. He asked all the doctors, scientists, epidemiologists, statisticians, basically the same question, which is the same question we ask anybody. Can you show me a study that shows that vaccines, this or that vaccine, is safe and effective? And I want to see a proper scientific study with controls. These people got the vaccine. These people didn't get the vaccine. Everything else was the same. Here's the outcomes. No fudging it. No sophistry. No baloney. Just show me the study. And they couldn't. And then he did the same thing with the viruses. So explain to me how you know there's a virus and show me the study that proves that they did that and showed that their virus exists and is made of what they say and causes what they say it does. And nobody had a study. Same. We've asked for 4 years. Show us a study. You say isolation is this. Show us a study. They don't show you a study. They show you papers, but then you point out the same problems over and over again. They just go blank. So you're not going to convince anybody telling them cholesterol doesn't cause heart disease, et cetera. But you can ask them, show me a study that says, done in a proper scientific way, that this substance that our body produces and our body produces more of with stress, that it is the cause of heart disease, so that you should ruin your life and change your diet and starve yourself to death in order to change this number. Show me the study. And then when you get the study, another thing that happens is it seems like the people who send us these studies and do these talks and write these papers, they actually never read the methods section. So you don't want to know what the conclusion or the abstract says in the paper. You don't want to know what the people who wrote this paper said about the study. They misinterpret things, they lie, they do all kinds of stuff. You only want to see what they did. And then you put that into your own sense of reason. Does what they did, is that able to prove that cholesterol and only cholesterol is a cause or the cause of heart disease? And I can guarantee you, your son will not be able to come up with that paper. At that point, hopefully, you can agree that there is no actual scientific, rational, logical argument that that claim is true. And then he gets to see what he wants to do with that. Now, a lot of emotional and kicking out of the tribe will come. You know, I've heard in order to be a good boy and to get along in society, you have to believe that cholesterol causes plaque and causes heart disease. So I don't want to go, I don't want to buck that system. I don't want to piss off my doctors or whatever. So all that will come into it. There's probably not much you can do about that. But what you can do is keep going back. Let's go over the study, the method section. Let's understand exactly what this study did to attempt to prove that this is the case. And I can guarantee you they won't have proved that cholesterol is the cause of heart disease. In which case, nobody who's claiming to be logical or rational should believe that or do anything in order to affect their cholesterol numbers. As far as I can see, that's the only way that's going to work. So, what's your thought on diverticulitis, causes, solutions, etc.? So, diverticulitis means an outpouching of the colon. It's sort of like you're getting extra appendixes. I don't know what the word is. A multiple appendix. So, an appendix is a little outpouching. It's like a little pouch that comes off of the junction of the small and large intestine. And then the large intestine goes from the right side, and then it comes up, and then it goes down across, that's transverse colon, and then the descending colon, and then it goes out through the rectum and anus, and the part in the ascending colon, sorry, the descending colon on the left side, if there's a long time too much pressure in that tube and not enough protection of the walls of the tube. So imagine on the left side from the ribs down to your groin area, you have this colon, this tube, the descending colon. It's a tube, it has folds in it and everything. And if you've got too much pressure and not enough protection of the walls, every once in a while, you'll pop out a little finger and you'll have a little pouch, looks sort of like an appendix, which is what you're supposed to have on the other side, but you're not supposed to have these little pouches on the left side. Now, these little pouches seem to get stuff stuck in the outflow of the pouches, like seeds and little pieces of food. And then you have a pouch which whose flow of in and out stuff, in this case stool, is blocked, and then you'd have blocked buildup stool in this pouch, and that can swell and that cause pain, and then it gets, quote, infected, which means the bacteria that are always there just start trying to remediate the situation, try to liquefy it. And then you're sick, and they call that diverticulitis. So why does that happen? It happens because of chronic constipation and because you don't have a protective layer coating the descending colon. So what is the protective layer? It's a gel, just like any tube that has water in the tube will have a protective gel layer. In this case, it's also a gel layer that's probably made by the colony of microorganisms that are normally living in your gut. And so you have basically a situation where you are supposed to have a certain colony, a mixture of bacteria and fungi and probably some other things living in your gut. And because of the way you live and the way you eat, and probably because of antibiotics, and probably because you eat a whole lot of bad food with all kinds of nasty stuff in it, you have the wrong kind of bacteria living in your gut. And so you don't have protection of the walls. And then you'll have constipation, because really the reason why you have bowel movements essentially is an outgrowth of this normal colony, the sort of microbiome in your gut. And so that's a not a healthy situation, and it produces all kinds of probably nasty byproducts which make it worse. So then you have a sort of toxic condition of the gut, of the colon, and the walls get weak, there's no gel protection, and then you get these ballooning out pouches, and then you get stuff stuck in the out pouches, and then you have full-blown diverticulitis. So in order to not have that, you have to have a life of having healthy bowel movements at least every day, at least once every day, and a healthy microbiome. And that's basically nourishing traditions diet and eating probiotic food and kefir and yogurt and sauerkraut and kimchi and fermented fish and fermented lots of things. And that's how you keep a healthy gut. Would you consider a digital watch to be unhealthy to wear, perhaps messing with our biofield? That's an interesting question. Back when I was still doing medicine, let me take a guess. 50 different times. I basically asked everybody, same question, how are you doing? And they'd say, whatever. And then I would say, when did you last feel well? And they would say a time, like 2 years ago. And then I would question them to make them tell me that they were feeling well. I played soccer. I could stay up late. I ate good food. I didn't have any digestive problems. I didn't have headaches. I felt good. So they say that, because I'm going to repeat that back to them later. And then, so what happened? A lot of times people say, well, I got divorced, or I changed my diet, or I got a vaccine, or I started taking this drug. Or so there was an obvious thing. I always looked for medical interventions, because I ended up thinking that 60 to 80% of the anvil, I call this the anvil theory, because if you're walking, never had a headache in your life, and you're walking down the street, an anvil falls on your head, and then you start having headaches, it's probably the anvil. So this is my anvil theory. So what happened? So I was fine, and then I got a shot, and then next thing you know, I'm not fine, and then I got cancer, and I got ALS, and I got this, and I got root canals, and or I was fine, and then I got a root canal, and then I got so-called MS, et cetera. So now, it was the case that in many cases, people couldn't identify anything that happened to them. They don't remember any shots or any medical interventions, any surgery, any dental procedure, any toxic exposure, no emotional, psychological things, no traumas, no nothing. And I would say, I'm guessing here, there was 50 times when I would go examine them after I questioned them for a half an hour or so. And I'd look in their ears and take their blood pressure and look in their irises and everything. And then I would say, oh, when'd you get that digital watch? And they said they were fine until 2 years ago, and then they weren't fine. Oh, I got it 2 years ago. I happen to remember because it was a birthday present, and I was born in October, and so that's I started getting sick in November. And I heard that 50 times. And so I wouldn't say that's proof, but I can tell you there is no possible way that I would wear a digital thing on my body, especially over my, pulse points. That's the sort of whatever they call it, an acupuncture in Ayurvedic measure, your medicine, your gathering points. There is no way that I would do that. I don't have any cell phone. I don't have any wireless device at all. I don't have any mobile device. I have a wired computer, and that's it. So there is no way. Now, have I looked into the scientific evidence that shows that they're harmful a little bit? And I don't have any to pull up right now. I just saw this. But there is no way that I would do that. And not only do I think that that's not right, I heard it in so many cases, and hopefully most of those people threw it in the garbage. So how to detoxify from pegylated lipid nanoparticles? So I have no idea anything specific about that, but I want to go back to what I said before, which is if all you know is castor oil packs, coffee enemas, and turpentine, you've hit the lipid-soluble, water-soluble, and general detoxification. And we are finding so many people who, if that's the main thing, as well as eating good food and barefoot walking and earthing and sunlight and all the usual things we talk about, movement, etc. Those are the three staples. So at this point, I would do those, and that'd probably be good enough. I don't think there's any evidence right now that that is specifically the problem. I mean, it's obviously a problem, but I don't know that there's any quote disease or myocarditis caused by these lipid nanoparticles. I'm not saying that's not the case. I don't know that, but I don't know that. That's the specific component. And so I don't know anything that's specifically shown to detoxify that specifically. And I don't think that's the way to think anyways. You don't look for a specific product. You've been poisoned with a multitude of things. Here's the general detoxification process. That's all you need. So finally, is there no contagion at all? No respiratory, no sexually transmitted, no food related? If true, is it only for microorganisms? What about fleas? Right, we should qualify that. As far as we can tell, there is no proof that bacteria or viruses, and I would even say fungus, are contagious, and meaning transmitted from one person to another, and therefore disease causing. If somebody disagrees, they're going to have to show me a study. Can't be done with viruses because they don't exist. But the bacteria and the bacteria alone, or the fungus and the fungus alone, exposed in a normal way to otherwise healthy group of people, everything else is the same in the control group, and that causes disease. That is the obvious, sane, logical, rational re way to sort that out. And so, until I see that study, as far as we can tell, that's not what's contagious. What is seemingly transmitted from people, there are sometimes chemicals. Daniel Royd has found that histamine levels can be transmitted from one person to another in very unusual situations. And emotional, psychological, belief systems, yawning, menstrual cycles, all living things are in constant and regular communication between each other. So, and they obviously have effects and they affect our health, but that is not what anybody means by contagious illness. That's what we mean by life. Okay, thanks everybody for joining me again, and I will hopefully see you next week.